Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the last Innovators Workbench of the season. We are winding up on an extreme high note. David will introduce our guest in just a minute. I want to take a minute for a couple of logistical details. One is if I could ask you please to put your cell phones off or into buzz mode. We are recording this. By the way, there are podcasts of this available. I think most of you know this, but if not, just check online for Innovators Workbench. I want to thank the sponsors for this evening's event. First of all, Wendover for loaning us David. Wilson Sonsini and Casey McGlynn, I think, is here somewhere. And Casey's over here. As you know, this is the point in the program where we acknowledge Price Waterhouse, and we are very sad to have to acknowledge the passing of Tracy Lefteroff, who was a creator of this series and was as you know, a great backer of this, of the whole biodesign program, and of lots of people in the audience. So we'll be missing him tonight. But we go on, and we have an absolutely wonderful program for tonight. And with no further ado, David, take it away.
Thank you, Paul. And I just want to echo Paul's words. Tracy was a good friend, not just to me, but to everyone in this room, and a passionate and strong supporter of this whole community, and he will be much missed. So we have as Paul said, we have just an outstanding finale for this year's season with John Dineen from GE Healthcare. And I think in a lot of respects, this series in a very broad sense has been all about technology and all of its ramifications and its aspects. But I think tonight, if I do my job right, and if John does his job right, you're going to hear a discussion about technology unlike any that you've heard before. So, John, let me just begin with a little bit of your background, particularly the parts of GE that you worked in before you came to healthcare, because it seems to me those other experiences really did shape the way you see the world of technology and the world of healthcare technology specifically. And when we were together a couple weeks ago, you said that you see yourself as an industrialist and a technologist, but not necessarily as a healthcare person. Can you tell me what you mean by that?
Yeah, I've my career has really been entirely based with GE, but GE is a big sandbox.
Right.
So I can spend time in a lot of different countries, which I did. I spent almost half of my career working in developing markets. I was sent to China right after Tiananmen Square to start GE's businesses there. I've lived in Japan, Singapore, Beijing, Shanghai, Guangdong, Paris, London, Mexico. So a lot of international experiences working in building businesses in the developing markets. And the other side of it would be technology, technology industries. I started as a telecommunications engineer working in a lab on what was really a private internet before there was an internet. We were able to connect companies like Apple and First Interstate Bank and offer them incredible applications like email on a private data network. And so that was really the beginning of my career. And from there, I've worked in a number of different industries. So telecommunications, the appliance industry, one of my first businesses I ran was a microwave oven business. It's like your first car. They don't give you a Porsche for your first car. You don't get something very glamorous. From there, you went to air conditioning, which is just a little bit more glamorous, and then electrical distribution and control. I made the electrical meters on the outside of your house. I know you've got your juices flowing now, right? And then to the plastics industry, where I ran the Lexan business and went back to Asia to run the Asian business there. Spent about 5 years in engineered thermoplastics, and then went to the transportation business, where GE's the world leader in diesel locomotives. And that, by far, was the coolest business card I've ever had. If somebody asks you what you do at a party and you say, I make locomotives, it stops the discussion right there. But that's really, it's a fabulous business. Half of the business is really IT technology. We do satellite train control systems, huge algorithms that help move the trains through the railroad. So it's a little bit more high-tech than that that image of a locomotive would give you. And then 5 years ago, I was asked to run the healthcare business.
So I wonder, there's an obvious question you're
trying to... Which my wife said is the first job I was actually qualified for, because my academic background was in biological sciences, genetics, and computer science.
I had two degrees. And had you not joined GE, you told me you would have joined a biotech company.
My other job offer was a small company called Genetics Institute. I'd probably be retired right now.
So there's an obvious question here, which I actually want to save to the end, which is how different healthcare technology plays out in healthcare than it does in those other. So let's save this for right now. But I think for all of us, I mean, GE touches us all in so many different ways. What's a little bit less clear to me is what are the component parts of GE's healthcare business. So give us a little bit of sense of the businesses that are under your, within your portfolio, and how, if at all, they kind of fit together. Is there a kind of strategic vision for what GE Healthcare does, or is it a kind of conglomerate of disparate parts that all touch on the healthcare industry?
It's an evolution of parts. It's a business that's been around for over 100 years. It was founded in X-ray, sort of a derivative of the lighting business, which was one of GE's first businesses. So you get to the X-ray tube, you get to the X-ray system, you start to develop CTs, MRIs. So really the core of the business is diagnostic imaging. And then we got into other clinical devices, the ultrasound business, anesthesia, so a very big equipment business, about $10 billion. And then from there, continued to follow what I call non-treatment-based trends, diagnostic trends and IT-based trends. So a big acquisition in Amersham, where we play largely in molecular diagnostics, both in vivo and in vitro, and also life sciences. We build the factories for almost all of the biopharmaceutical companies. So of all the monoclonal antibody therapies out there, most of them are manufactured with our process technologies. We'd either do cell culturing, cell expression systems, chromatography, which is a separation filtration system. So we build the plants for all the drugs. So life sciences, and then as I said, IT.
Yeah. So talk a little about the IT offering, because I think that as I think about the other companies that we've had here, the other folks we've had here, healthcare IT is one that's remained a little more of an outlier, not one that a lot of people integrate. Is the healthcare IT, is it integral to the other diagnostic imaging and life science businesses? Is it a separate thing? Can I buy just healthcare IT services from GE, or do I have to buy the whole suite?
It started as an adjacency. So, when we moved to digital imaging, you had to move digital images around. And so they developed PAC systems and other department. From there, other departmental systems, pharmacy systems, and from there, EMR systems. So it started as a very close connection to the core equipment business, but has continued to expand and will continue to expand.
So give us a sense of where, before we move back into the kind of what we would consider to be the kind of core, but give us a sense of the state of the healthcare IT. We're hearing so much about mobile health, digital health today, which seems at least, I don't know, I mean, describe for me, tangentially related core to healthcare IT. We seem to be at the beginning of this revolution in an industry which has been slow to pick up on IT.
Early phases. I mean, you go home tonight and you want to look at, you probably your two most important information assets as an individual, your financial information, your medical information. You can go home and do a lot of things on the computer to assess your net worth in 45 minutes. You're going to have a hard time doing the same thing from a health standpoint. You think about the customer service aspects of checking in or booking a flight on an airline and trying to do the same thing for medical care. Mm-hmm. So from a customer service standpoint, from a patient information standpoint, the healthcare system is, depending on what country you're in, at least 20 years behind the financial services or the airline industry. So we're in very early stages, but there's a tremendous opportunity, and it's really starting to get rolling. We're going through what is a very important first phase, which is digitization, moving from paper to information. And that is a painful and expensive phase, but it's a natural foundation and required foundation to get to the next two steps, which I consider connect and then work the data into useful information support decisions. We're just moving through that foundational phase and into the next two. And I think you're going to move to, when you get go from EMRs to middleware to applications, that's when we're going to see a lot of juice and productivity, and God knows the healthcare system needs it.
So do you think there'll come a time when GE's healthcare IT business will be larger than its diagnostic imaging business? I mean, we tend to think about GE as a purveyor of large-scale X-ray, CT, MRI units, but those seem to be relatively mature, unless I'm wrong, businesses, whereas you say we're only at the beginning of healthcare IT, and everyone's talking about big data and what big data can do for healthcare. Could you see GE just defining itself as a
without
healthcare
a
IT business?
Without a doubt. And you're really in early, you've got the equipment, which is really an infrastructure play. The IT plays, we're a couple $1 billion, and we're in very early innings, as I said. And the same thing for molecular medicine. Both of those are probably where the diagnostic imaging equipment industries were a long time ago. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of runway in both of those areas. And both of them have the ability to make a profound impact on economically on healthcare and from a quality standpoint.
So when you describe PACS as a kind of first step into this whole space, it's clear to see how you go from diagnostic imaging to PACS to a broader healthcare IT footprint. But Amersham seems to have been somewhat of an outlier. You acquired UAN. Talk a little bit more about what you're doing in the life science space, and in particular, to what degree does GE buy its way into new spaces? To what degree do you take all the extraordinary resources that are within GE and other businesses and say, we could do something in healthcare with that kind of technology?
I'll answer the second question first, which is, in a healthy company, we're 50-60% organic in developing our own technologies, and then 50-60% buying your way in. We tend to buy when we need a sizable footprint in a new space, and that's what Amersham was. So going to the first question, diagnostic imaging was pretty well established on the physiology side, and helping one diagnose, do I have a disease, do I have a cancer? We saw the need to really get into molecular diagnostics to answer the second and third rounds of questions, which is, what kind of cancer is this? So we see a natural analog in terms of the development of the diagnostic industry. These days, we're starting to see them come together, again, with big data, multiplexing this information and coming up with better and more precise diagnostic interpretations. Again, not just is there a problem, but what kind of problem, or is the problem reoccurring? Those are things that molecular medicine is going to help with.
So give us a sense of what Amersham was, and when I guess why Amersham as your way into this space. When Omar was here, Paul mentioned Omar Ishraq was here just last month, we talked about, as someone who went from a diagnostic company and specifically General Electric to Medtronic, which is one of the first or second largest, what I would call therapeutic device company.
He went to a therapeutic,
That there seems to be this bias in the healthcare system against diagnostics and in favor of therapeutics. Although, as you're describing it, and as we spoke a couple weeks ago, there's this going to be this integral link between diagnostics and therapeutics. But why did you begin with Amersham? And does the notion that diagnostics is undervalued in some sense in the healthcare system, does it resonate with GE, or do you basically take the view that, hey, we're doing pretty well and we're just as happy as could be about with the role diagnostics plays in the healthcare system?
I'd start with, if you were to cull us out, we'd probably be the largest and most profitable healthcare company in the world. So that's not shabby.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So I think it's working out okay for the company in diagnostics. But there are big profit pools on the therapeutic side. And I think if you get into Amersham, the interesting thing was half of Amersham does allow us to play in the therapeutic side, but it's not directly making treatments. We build the factories that enable the development of the treatments. So we're participating in the therapeutic side, but really more as an infrastructure technology play, which is how GE plays. We're not a pharma company.
Do you aspire to be a pharma company?
No, not really. This gives us a pretty good inroad there. We find ourselves there occasionally. You get into MR-guided focused ultrasound. Mm-hmm. We do some work in the stem cell area. So there are times when we find ourselves sort of stepping over align, and it's okay, we do that, but we really see our strength in more or less in the diagnostic side and the information side. That being said, what we're finding these days is we and the therapeutic companies have to work much more closely than we ever had. We were always allowed to work in our own swim lane and really not worry about what's going on in the therapeutic swim lanes. We made Swiss Army knives, diagnostically speaking. Mm-hmm. CT or an MR, we don't really care what the treatment is. We're going to find the problem, and then the doctor would decide, you know, how do I pivot to the appropriate therapy. These days, we're finding that we actually have to work together. Much closer coupling of the diagnostics and the therapies, and these Swiss Army knives are becoming scalpels, specialized either through the hardware configuration or the software to work with a specific therapeutic. That's a huge challenge for us and for the pharma companies or the biopharmaceutical companies.
Do you
companies.
Do that in collaboration with pharma companies, or do you identify an opportunity and say, if we build this, there's no way Merck or Pfizer can ignore what we're doing here?
Yeah.
Do you do this as a client?
You take amyloid imaging, for example, mm-hmm. which is we've got to find the patients for these drugs. So there's some of them are very clear cut. Others are less so. Others are we have a diagnostic capability, but we don't know exactly what type of patient or what type of side effect the pharmaceutical company is working for, and we're really starting to we've got what I call awkward mechanisms mm-hmm. right now to try to get our teams to work with their teams, and we're seeing some early success. But we have a long way to go until. We've really tightened up the interaction. But I'd say it's necessary for both of us. If I have a diagnostic that doesn't result in the modification of a treatment, I'm not going to make a lot of money on that. Vice versa, if you have a therapeutic and you can't find your patient base, we're going to have trouble with that. So everybody realizes the problem, but we're still trying to develop the rhythms, the operating rhythms to work together.
Obviously you can make a lot of money with a new therapeutic with a diagnostic that pinpoints or makes more accurate a therapeutic. But I know some diagnostic executives who say, look, if we're really going to develop the diagnostic that's going to point to the more efficient therapeutic, we should be more valued. We, in fact, should get some of that, a view that's not particularly popular with the therapeutic companies, with the biopharma companies whose view of life is, hey, look, it's our drug and we're going to capture the lion's share of it. How do you make more money than you currently are from diagnostics if you're making that therapeutic link?
Yeah.
Can you make that argument to pharma companies, do you think?
It's starting to, but it is tough. I think you got to look. They turn around and say, well, I'm investing 20 times more than you are. And you do have to look at this on an ROI basis. Some of the diagnostics require much less investment and still have great returns. Although they're not capturing the entire value proposition. There are other diagnostics, like, go back to amyloid imaging agents. These are basically pharmaceuticals that we're developing. They're injecting people. Those are huge investments. And we do have to examine sort of the economic relationship between us and the therapeutic.
So Steve Osterley, I think, has very interestingly pointed out that one of the big differences between pharma and device is that medical device companies are small R and big D, very little money into research, a lot of money spent on the development side, and drug companies are the exact opposite. A lot of money spent in research, a lot of failures, and relatively little spent on development because you fail in research more often than not. When you think not just about the life sciences area of GE, but about the diagnostic imaging and the healthcare infrastructure, is GE, in terms of its internal development efforts, more of a research house, or more of a development house?
No, it's more of a development. It's in between.
Mm-hmm. But how much do you spend on R&D? If it's
about 10% of sales every year.
So that's pretty high.
Yeah. Yeah. But it would be in between the two.
Okay.
Yeah. And it depends on the product lines as well. You've got some of the product lines that are much more mature and others that are quite novel, and you have to spend quite a bit.
Is there a lot of room left in diagnostic imaging in terms of advanced technologies coming down the road? I mean, are there more capabilities? And we're going to talk a little bit about reverse innovation, which seems to a certain degree to cut against that. But when you think about what the current diagnostic imaging suite looks like in a typical hospital and where it could go, do you say we're pretty close to where it, to really optimal diagnostic efficiency? Or do you say there's still a lot more technological that we
there's
can do?
There's a, you know, in every space, and that's the thing I love about healthcare, is I can look around and compare this to other industries in a big company like GE, and there's so much more white space from a technology standpoint. We don't know how major disease classes even work in the body. There's so much more that still has to be figured out. I mean, until recently, we couldn't see an amyloid plaque. We're not even sure if amyloid plaque is the right thing to be looking at. Just there are more questions than answers, and I think that's an encouraging thing in healthcare. If I go back to diagnostic imaging equipment, there's a lot more that we can do in image. We're really starting to walk into the area of molecular imaging, which is very, very young. There's now, people are realizing that this image, this what we've been imaging, these pictures are actually rich in all kinds of other data that can be analyzed in different ways or can be multiplexed with genomic data, immunohistochemistry. So there's a lot more we can do with the data. There's also something that may seem a little bit more mundane, but it's important, is that the imaging platforms are broadening. So, you know, much like Apple has gone from a computer to a phone that is really a computer,
right?
You see that happening across diagnostic imaging. So product line CTs are going to have to go from $100,000 to $2 million. Ultrasound already does that. We do go from literally from handhelds,
right,
to large standalone computing systems, and that's a good thing for the businesses.
But although as you
broad move, portfolios,
yeah, but as you move to their broad portfolios, the smaller, less expensive devices become much more useful, much more effective is not the word I'm looking for, but much more powerful in their technological capability. How do you continue to sell a $2 million CT machine when a much smaller scale can now do things that 10 years ago, a million-dollar CT machine couldn't do?
Because we advance both ends of the spectrum. So there's always a need for sort of premium computing horsepower and applications, and then there's a need for, simpler designs. And literally, we have four categories of product. You go from a super value to a premium product, and they're engineered and manufactured in different parts of the world. And, you know, analysts don't like it. They say, oh, you got, you're mixing down. You are mixing down from a price point standpoint, but you're broadening your portfolio and broadening your sales. So we've got businesses where the average price per unit is 50% of what it was 10 years from now, but the business is three times larger,
mm-hmm,
and the contribution margin rates are 10 points higher. That works out financially.
So we're dancing around this whole notion of reverse innovation and where technology is going. Let me back that up by going, I know that the other lens through which you see the world is that of a global presence.
Right.
And you personally spend a lot of time in places like China and other emerging markets. What was it like starting a business 6 months after Tiananmen Square in China? Was it chaos? Was it a great time to set up state? I mean, how much did the political environment or situation at that time affect you? And was there any temptation to say, I know we spent 2 years planning this, but this is not a great time to do this?
Yeah, there are probably 50 times that you'd say this is too hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have basic financial systems, you don't have banking systems, you can't convert your currency. We worry about reimbursement and regulatory pressures here. You had a vacuum of those things. But we did know that these are going to be big markets, and there's going to be growth there, and we have to persevere and continue to invest, and that served us well.
Was there any suspicion that here was this giant U.S. company coming at a time when there was a tremendous political sensitivity? They weren't exactly delighted at a big U.S. company coming and putting a stake in the ground?
There are areas where you compete with national industries, and it's almost a bit of a security issue. So in the aviation industry, in the railroad industries, in the energy industries, countries don't want to be held hostage to other countries' technologies and want to develop their own market. There are other places where consumer industries where they give you free access.
Mm-hmm.
Problem is you have to compete with people that are smarter and faster and know the consumer better. We're in a mid-market where they need your technology because they're more interested in building out the healthcare system than in creating the industry of itself. They know with time that'll come. So you get a more clear shot at markets around the world, like Russia, like China, like Africa. You get, you know, I wouldn't say it's unencumbered, but you get pretty reasonable access to markets like that in healthcare. It's probably one of the better platforms to globalize that I've seen in my career.
So, a lot of people point to just the enormous patient populations of places like China and India and point to what's sometimes called the top of the pyramid, the 400 million or so. Size of the U.S. market. Was that your initial target there? Because there's this, what some people call the middle of the pyramid. So it's quite a billion, but a huge number of people who can't afford quite don't have quite the bias toward Western technology, but boy, there's just a lot of those patients out there and they're coming in. How much is your business mixed? And was your initial target in GE that upper, we love Western technology and we were trained in Western?
Yeah, that's where it starts because you're a premium player. You have higher end technology. With urbanization in China and India, you'd have very high end hospitals that need and want that technology. And that's where you start. But then quickly you have to broaden out the product line. We see most of these markets like China are bi or trimodal. There's significant demand for things at the high end, the medium end, and the low end.
So as I talk to a lot of other medtech CEOs, I still think there's a lot of skepticism about moving into China. They worry about things like IP issues, difficulty of distribution tapping the market, and whether you can actually build a profitable business there. Obviously, GE's passed that. As you talk to someone who is not thinking about this in 1989, but is thinking about this in 2013, 2014, do you think those fears are overblown, or is your view that these are just things you have to work through, and the sooner you get to working through them, the sooner you'll get to some kind of stable business?
Yeah, we're in a weird world now. I used to spend my time in our strategic discussions talking about worrying about the risk in China and India and what's going to happen to our business. And actually, these days, I spend more time talking about the risk of my business in the U.S. than I do. I'm not being tongue-in-cheek about that. This is the most dynamic and turbulent environment in terms of change and payment systems and making an investment.
In the U.S.
They're many of these developing markets are on a straight-out build-out. I know what play they're going to run. I'm comfortable with where they're going. I may not like it, mm-hmm. but I know where it's going to end up in 3 or 4 years. So we have a great deal of clarity about our businesses there, and they're good. I mean, China's over a $2 billion business for us. It's as healthy as any market in the world in terms of profitability, the growth. It's been growing 25% CAGR for 5 years.
Is it your biggest emerging market? Where does it rank to India or Russia?
It's growth rate and size, and China wins on both of those. It's the biggest circle on the chart, and it's growing at one of the fastest rates with consistency. With consistency. Some markets are up, down, up, down, up, down. That's been straight shot growth. And they're going to continue to invest in it. They're going to build out that healthcare system.
Do you think so? There's been some concern that the Chinese economy is slowing a little bit. There was a front page article in the Times that you guys aren't finding it easy to get jobs these days. Is it experiencing any of the
China's going to fail? 25 years now, I've been reading. Eventually, one of these guys is going to be right. China's going to slow down or stop.
Maybe in 25 years.
Yeah, but it's been going on. You've been hearing that. This is the year. This is a slowdown. It may happen in some industries, but right now these guys have 5-year plans. They do what they say they're going to do.
So much of the discussion about emerging markets like China and India tends to focus on them as places into which we sell products.
Exactly.
Importers of technology. What do you see in terms of these markets as exporters of technology, and in particular as creators of innovative technology?
This is a big... We've started by selling into the markets. You go through this process of localization. So you sell in. You develop a sales force. You start to modify the products. You start building factories. And most of our factories are built not as labor arbitrage. In high-tech products, there's not enough labor to arbitrage. You're really building the factories to get into the market itself. And then you start to say, I need a different product portfolio if I'm really going to grow here. So you start investing in engineering. Some of that engineering starts off as what I call colonial engineering. We use them as that's our labor arbitrage. You're using the engineers to build subcomponents for a system. Here, you take this little piece, when you're done, bring it back here, and I'll put it into my larger system, and I'll do all the systems engineering in the U.S. or Europe. We've gotten by that, and we've started to develop on-the-ground system capability, and now we've got big engineering teams in India, in China, and what we found is that we're getting them focused on product technologies that are, I'd say, industrially and culturally relevant in their market. Mm-hmm. What do I mean by that? Japan is a center of excellence for what are our mid-tier products. Our Japanese engineers are fabulous at getting a lot of stuff into a small package and really making it efficient, real focus on ergonomics. They are the kings of that sort of mid-tier product in our business. And the reason is they're exposed to that every day, mm-hmm. in their house, in their home, in their factories. So they're just good at it because it's natural. Our U.S. and European teams have grown up being the premium players. And frankly, they don't get excited about, they see a value product as defeaturing. Mm-hmm. And that's the one way to screw up a value product is try to defeature. You stand in front of a customer and say, what do you want me to take off of this?
But isn't that exactly...
No, don't take that off. I'll take this off. No, you put it back on. It's a wattless exercise if you've ever watched it.
But isn't that exactly what reverse innovation, which a term that GE coined,
yeah.
isn't that what you're about? Isn't it about defeaturing?
No, it's about building from the white piece of paper the product that is relevant to and responsive to the pressures of that environment. So Japan was in the middle, the U.S. with the academic orientation of the last 10 or 20 years, premium stuff. And then India. India is a consumer-driven healthcare system. It is the most Darwinian healthcare system in the world. Consumer's going to pay out of his pocket for the use of that technology. And consumers buy much better than governments. They are ruthless. They put incredible pressure on. So the products and technologies can't be 10% less. They've got to be 10% of.
Mm-hmm.
And our engineering teams there they live with that economic pressure every day. If you don't get 50 to 75% of the cost out, you're going to fail as a business. Respond to that.
But in an article written by GE executives in Harvard Business Review, reverse engineering was described as a 50% solution at a 15% price. The 50% solution seems to suggest that these are, if not defeatured, less capable. Is that the trade-off that consumers are willing to make? I don't need all these bells and whistles as long as you bring it in less expensively. Or in a Darwinian consumer market, do they want all the bells and whistles, but they just want you to give it to them at 10%?
If you do that, if you try to defeature or give it at a lower price, it's a recipe for going out of business. You really have to start with, that white piece of paper and build up. And you've got to be thinking about the economics every step of the way. And that's what you see in India. Healthcare is as an industrialist, healthcare is a bit of an interesting industry to me. And every other one of our businesses or the ones I've been in, you have to come with a performance outcome, a quality outcome, and a cost outcome. We do a new jet engine, that thing's got to be more fuel efficient, it's got to be a lower price, and it's got to have lower emissions. People in the healthcare community grew up with just make it better, take the technology to the next level. We didn't put them in a box and say, I want all three of them. And if you're an engineer and somebody puts you in that box and says, I want all three of these things, that you sweat. We've gotten away with more slices, bigger magnet, take it to the next level. Somebody will pay for it. That's over. It's over everywhere.
So you're leading right into the discussion.
In India, it's that pressure on steroids. So you do have to, anything that's extra or not necessary or doesn't contribute to the workflow, because people are buying this out of their own pocket. The guy who's negotiating with you is thinking about how many patients can I get through this machine a day. He's running at three shifts.
So you're getting right into the discussion of technology that I want to come to at the end. Let me just ask you two more questions about emerging markets. One of which is, as you're hearing from analysts, you know, there's some perception that, I mean, you're doing great in China. You're making a profitable business, $2 billion. And you say it's one of those profitable businesses. But some people find that hard to kind of wrap their minds around. Yeah. They figure that these markets have to be price pressure, margin pressure, difficult to make money. And what's the secret to not being just squeezed out of a profitable business in a market where, you know, that kind of technology, that kind of premium technology play isn't really relevant, or it isn't really work?
It's important to re-engineer your business to and make sure that it stays responsive to the needs of that market and that healthcare system. And if you try to export your product or your business model, you're going to run into trouble. Now, that might get you started. And truthfully, I think that got us started in most of our businesses. But you immediately move past that sort of opportunistic export model into how do I run this as GE Healthcare China? And we've gotten to that point. Rachel Dwan, who runs China for me, she runs that business and has a lot of say as to what we do with the product lines around the world.
Did you need a partner in China in order to launch?
It's interesting. Originally, 25 years ago, we did have a partner, the Ministry of Health.
Oh, really?
So partner with your customer. They had a small 10-20% equity share, and then a couple of years into that, we bought that out. Most of our businesses tend to be wholly owned, but pragmatism. If to get access in a market, if you really need a partner to get going, you find a partner.
So when I think about China, just one final question about China, and I think about two different technologies and how they played out on the therapeutic side. You look at something like drug-eluting stents. I was talking to one leading interventional cardiologist, and we were talking about, you know, what will happen when Abbott, Medtronic, and Boston Scientific get to China. And he was noting that the top three drug-eluting stent companies in China are all Chinese, and they have 80% of the market.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, what's Abbott going to do? He said, they're not going to do anything. He said, that market goes, unlike Europe, which quickly went to the U.S. companies. Look at, conversely, orthopedic implants, where now at least two of the top Chinese companies, have now been bought by American U.S.-based companies. Two different models for how U.S. companies are going to compete or play in that space. When I think about China in the space you play, I think about Mindray, which has been extremely successful and now trying to reach out outside of China. What will competition for GE look like in China over the next 5 to 10 years? Do you think you'll be fighting against entrenched Chinese companies, or is it a misnomer to think about GE as a U.S. company based doing business in China?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a misnomer. People tend to think of these businesses as big oligopolies. The ultrasound business, which is one of our more successful businesses, has 65 competitors, and probably three more every year, five more every year. So we're always faced with new entrants and startups, many of them in China, in India. The way we think about it is, and your stent example is a good one. I don't know enough about the industry, but that scenario is one where if you don't get into that market and start playing in that market and serving the needs of that market, it becomes a very, very fertile breeding ground for your competitor 10 years from now. So people, you know, if you don't go there, you're going to be dealing with some startup from that country in your own market in 10 years. And that's how I've always thought about it. It's not just an opportunity. I'd rather be playing the game in somebody else's backyard and not my own. That's defense.
Right.
But they said the best defense is a good offense.
Right.
That's one of the ways you think about globalization. And if you wake up and there are five locals that own 80% of the market, you got two choices. You're out of that market, or you got to buy one of them. And both of those are not the most desired outcomes. Those are hard.
And what raised that is actually your discussion in Japan, where a significant number of the top diagnostic imaging companies, Toshiba, Shimatsu, are Japanese companies. And when you think about diagnostic imaging itself, GE, Siemens, Philips, yeah. Japanese companies. It's not at all like the rest of the device industry. Very U.S. focused in terms of the headquarter business. It's
well, remember, GE Healthcare bought Thomson, CJR, which is a very big diagnostic imaging company in Europe. About YMS in Japan, Yokogawa Medical System. So those initial steps, those initial forays were acquisitions, and then you start to build the scale from there. So sometimes you do have to, you know, you have to start with an acquisition that gives you presence. It's so hard to just try to run the business as an export model. You'll never make it. And that's what I think a lot of the smaller companies have to struggle with, which is, how do I get access to India from California? You don't.
Yeah. You got to be in India to do that. So I want to go back to the comment you just made, because it resonated with something that you said to me a couple of weeks ago, which is that, you know, in terms of where GE might go next, you're saying that healthcare is very seductive from a technology point of view because there's so much white space.
Yeah.
So many areas like cancer and diabetes where there's still huge and obvious unmet needs, so many frontiers. So how do you decide where do you go next?
Yeah.
Is there anything that's off the limits, off the table for you guys?
No, not really. I mean, we don't want to go somewhere where we don't know much. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to end up in a neighborhood where you don't understand the technologies, you don't understand the market. Bad things happen there when you get way outside of your scope, but your competencies. So that's important. We don't have bounds on the scope, but we tend to look at something and say, can we run this? Can we play in this industry? Do we know what we're doing? Can we make sound strategic decisions? And those are the bounds that we put on things. And if we don't know if we can run it, I've made small acquisitions in new spaces just to get in and learn every day, so that we stop hiring consultants and everything else, but to live in that neighborhood in a small way. And if we blow it, it's okay. It's a couple $100 million. Which may sound like a lot, but there could be more painful lessons for a big company like ours, and that's what we think about.
So I was talking to Joe Almeida of Covidien a couple of months ago, and though Covidien is today the third or fourth largest device company, depending on how you count them, he was saying that there are practical limits to how large an acquisition Covidien could do. We were talking actually relative to J&J's recent acquisition of Synces, the orthopedics company. I may be wrong with this, but I would imagine a company the size of GE Healthcare, especially with the backing of corporate GE, size of acquisition is really not an issue for you guys. Is that a fair assumption? If so, how do you view M&A as a shaper of GE's business going forward? What kind of considerations or strategies shape the kind of healthcare business you're trying to become? Because I would imagine, maybe I'm wrong about this, if you wanted to, you could buy just about anybody you wanted to in this industry.
Yeah. I mean, size isn't a huge...
Maybe short of Merck or
Pfizer. Yeah, I know. Huge. The dollar amount isn't the biggest driver because there are deep pockets, and the company spends, you know, billions every year on acquisitions. Pricing is a big consideration.
And multiple, pricing of the dealer pricing.
Multiples are very, very high in this industry, so you've got to be convinced that in a more challenging environment, in the U.S. and Europe, you have to be comfortable that the asset can live up to the price points and the multiples. And I worry a lot about about that. And then the third is what I just talked about, which is, can we run this business? Are we going to be able to grow the business? And that's often a limitation of our experience and sort of intellectual capabilities in that particular segment. But then there are also spaces where we say we're going to have to go in this direction, and we're not going to get there organically. So we've got to start, you know, putting some assets in place that we can eventually build around some flagstones, if you will.
So I know you have an initiative called GE Healthy Imagination.
Yeah.
What is that? Is it a corporate venture fund in the conventional sense? And someone told me that it started actually as an investment vehicle in wellness and prevention, but has grown beyond that. What's kind of the scope and the direction and the kind of mandate of GE Healthy and Imagination?
Well, we started it as a fund because we're in the healthcare space, we're in the energy space, we have funds in industries or sectors that we live and spend a lot of time on, and Sue Siegel's here. She's running this for us now, and I think Sue's done a terrific job in helping us put together a strategy that allows me to answer this question better, and that is, we're finding that you know, these days is obviously less venture out there. Big companies are more careful about the assets that they're buying because they don't know if they can nurture this thing till getting approval and getting reimbursement 10 years out. So you have this space here from, say, your proven concept to reasonably scaled asset, and we look at the fund as being able to step in and serve that need, and to do it in spaces where I may have some interest in that asset 7, 8, 9, 10 years from now, but I don't have that much interest. I may talk about it, but I'm not going to take good care of that toddler in years 3 through 7. Mm-hmm. I may actually destroy it in a big business. So we need an organization that is going to help scale these things and nurture them in a different way that the larger corporate entity is not, can't, or isn't that good at.
But does it have to have a strategic fit with GE's larger healthcare business?
Usually, yeah.
Because,
I mean, that's helpful. Because,
yeah.
Again, one, we have some competence, and two, there may be an opportunity for the assets to converge in the long term.
Because your businesses are such large scale. I mean, diagnostic imaging, healthcare IT, which is only going to explode, and even life sciences. This isn't like Medtronic's corporate venturing or Covidien's corporate venturing, where they can take a small catheter-based device, which may grow to be $75, $100 million in sales and you know, have a material impact on the sales rep's, bag or portfolio.
Yeah.
What kind of opportunities are you identifying that could fit within the scale of GE?
Yeah. I mean, we look at trends that could impact our business, like, you know, trends in molecular medicine or trends in consumer health.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the technologies there. That, again, they may be a little bit off scope for the core business, but we think that segment may be something that the core business is very interested in. We still have, we make our own investments in small technologies today within the business. Mm-hmm. that are easy fits. So there's small businesses in life sciences that we think can be $500 million businesses 5 or 6 years ago. So we're still doing the same thing that you talked about in Covidien, but we found the need for a slightly different platform in the Health Imagination Fund.
You mentioned before how different. I want to come back to, because we're running right up against time here, back to the whole notion of how healthcare differs from the other industries, both the other industries that you've worked in, yeah, and the other industries that GE, because you must hear from your colleagues in other businesses how difficult. You said to me when we were together that GE's healthcare bets are the most challenging of all of our industries. And you talked about that three-part. Give us a sense of what makes investing in healthcare, or let's say what makes innovation in healthcare so challenging and how different it is from other industries.
Yeah, I'd say there is more white space. There's more true innovation. Now, you're solving problems where, you know, the science is still evolving. You know, we're investing in our life sciences business in stem cell and cell therapy business, and that's going to take a while to play out. And so they're longer timetables than some of the other businesses. I'd say right now if you go around the world, everybody's got a different healthcare system, and nobody likes their healthcare system, and every healthcare system is changing. So they're moving. Every healthcare system is a moving target. And the U.S. is probably one that is one of the more challenging. The fundamental payment mechanisms are changing. The financial reward mechanisms, incentives are changing. So you're going from a cost-plus world, a piecework system that pays for activity, to one that's likely going to be paying for results, a fixed-price world. I mean, there's no more profound change than your entire economic reward system changing overnight. So we look at a product and you got to say, hey, this would be great in the piecework world over mm-hmm. the next 3 or 4 years, but this is going to be a cost that the healthcare system is not going to tolerate in 5 or 6 or 7 years from now. You've got sort of a very dynamic regulatory environment in terms of how things are changing and where the FDA will play, where they won't. And then you've got reimbursement, which is very dynamic. You may have a great model based on today's reimbursement, that you could wake up and it could be cut in half 3 years from now, 4 years from now. And that's a, you know, when the economic system is changing, when the reimbursements, the pricing is changing that dramatically, and where the regulatory side is changing, that's a lot of flux to invest in. That's a lot of things can go wrong when you're looking at a 10-year cash flow on an asset with all of that change going on around you. So we've got to be a lot more careful these days, and we've got to ask much tougher questions.
So let me kind of wrap up with one final question. You talked about the world in flux and how it's changed. You need to be economically disruptive as well as clinically disruptive. It seems to me that at least for a company like General Electric, you're large enough and have enough resources to influence, if not outright drive, the direction of that change.
Yeah.
One, is that true, or does GE feel as buffeted and as much caught in the vortex as every other company does? Do you feel, because of the resources you have behind you, that you're a little bit more in command, a little more in control of the outside, the external environment than maybe some other company might?
Command and control would be strong words. But able to influence is probably where I'd park that. But we do see ourselves as we are a global infrastructure company. So we don't go and just say I'm selling devices to doctors, but we walk into any market around the world and say, how do we help improve this healthcare system with our technologies? And we interface, you know, with at the top of the government. We interface with the Minister of Health in his team or her team in every single country in the world, and then down into the hospital leadership, and then down to a clinical level. So our commercial approach around the world plays at every one of the levels. And there is a, you know, if you're a global infrastructure company, it helps to be big and to be able to influence at all of those levels.
So one final question, then we'll open up to the floor for a couple of questions. And that is, so it seems to me, again, as I said at the very beginning, of all the companies that we've had here, General Electric plays by different rules than everyone else. If you're a small company, single product company, venture-backed company, and you're saying to yourself, John, I agree with you, it's exactly right. What do I do? Have any thoughts or perspectives about what companies without that perspective, without those resources, without that kind of breadth and depth of infrastructure, how they can cope with this kind of world?
Yeah, I'd say when you've got an asset like GE Healthcare, I'm capable of pushing, mm-hmm. as the last question and answer indicated. There's a good push factor. We've got a lot of gravity. We've got ability to influence it at multiple levels. You don't have that if you're a small company. You have technology. I think you have to have extraordinary pull for your product or technology. You have to have a value proposition that is crystal clear, because you don't have the energy to push that value proposition. It has to be so compelling that in that 5-minute discussion, people get it. And they don't just, it's no longer just that a cardiologist gets it. But you have to say, is the Minister of Health going to get this? Is the Minister of Finance going to get this? Does the hospital CEO going to get this and feel like they're going to make money? And does the clinician get it? Now, does the patient get it? But I think you have to look at all those customers that mm-hmm. you have and say, I'm not going to be able to jam this on them. They gotta see it and want it and pull. And that's investable theme.
Great. Well, we're right up against time. I do want to leave the floor for questions. Let's thank John. John, thanks so much for coming here and sharing your perspective. Like I said, to me, it's a very different story than one we've heard. If there's any questions, come to the microphone. Here's one coming up right here.
Hi, John. I was wondering, talking about India and how large GE is, have you tried to go around the whole radical innovation route and see if your finance arm, which is really huge, can actually provide insurance when you see that you have some products which are slightly more expensive than people are willing to pay for, but then you can actually provide them with insurance on the other hand and say that you can just buy this insurance and so now your product is affordable.
So you know, bring GE.
GE
capital
finance
into the picture to help. That's interesting.
Right. Insurance or to underwrite my cost problem. So, I mean, they, We'll go in and help with models. And we do have to change the business models. I think this is where you're taking it, which is you could go in and sell, instead of selling a piece of equipment, you go with a photocopier type of model, which is you pay per scan, if you will. So we are looking at, and then we're doing PPPs with the government, where we go in, we actually take equity with one of the owners in the hospital. So we do have to experiment a lot with different business models and different transactional models. But we don't really use them. You can't underwrite not having the right product in these markets. So you do have to make sure that the products themselves have to stand on their own right.
I have a question to follow up to your last one, and that is, it seems to be clear in emerging markets that you might have a discussion at the highest levels of governments with the Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Health. But when you get to the more developed countries, are you having the same conversation with the U.S. and with England and with France?
Yeah, and it's easier to have it with a single-payer system. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, we do it everywhere. In the U.S., you end up dealing with a lot of, you're working this at many different angles, even state governments, federal governments, CMS, FDA. So it's a little bit more challenging in that you get a lot of different parties that you have to work. But in the UK, yeah, we spend a lot of time with the NHS leadership.
That's it. Well, again, are there any other questions? If not, John, thank you very much. There's a reception outside, and again, we really very much appreciate your coming here.
Thanks.
Oh, did you want to, Ted, come up and ask a question? Cutting you off here, but we are only got one behind that too.
Quick question here. You're talking about dealing with the higher levels of government. Now, this would probably you probably run into some FCPA issues, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and that's probably a real concern for you.
Yeah, it's in every one of, I mean, in every industry for you, every industry you play in, every country that you play in, you're going to run into FCPA issues. And in healthcare, a number of different requirements with regard to dealing with healthcare professionals. So it's a challenging compliance space. We've got to make sure that we have very strong compliance programs in place in every country in the world that we play in. And you know, if you're a big company, there'll be issues that crop up. But by and large, we run to the same codes, the same requirements in all of these developing markets. You're going to lose business. There are countries we have to exit sometimes because of the practices in the country. There are market segments or countries where we've decided that the public channel, the public healthcare channel, is just too treacherous, and we walk away from that segment. Maybe spend more time focusing on a segment like the private segment. And then you'll see the country start to clean things up, and then we'll move back into that segment. But there have been market segments and countries that we've just said, not now. You know, it's just too treacherous. It is too difficult. We can't, we can't operate in that environment. You go focus on other things and wait it out. And most of the time you can come back to those countries because it does get cleaned up.
So. One more question.
Hi, John. Nagesh Malagari.
Nagesh.
I'm actually a GE alum. I used to work in imaging and patient monitoring. I'm curious as to how the Healthy Imagination Fund is performing and how some of that investments can be made here in the Silicon Valley area.
And I should point out one statistic. Someone told me that of the 30 investments, 29 have been in the U.S. and one in Europe.
Yeah, most of them in Europe. Frankly, a lot of them around here, right, Sue? I think you have the benefit of having the organization run by a local that you know well. And as part of the community, and listen, that was by design. And then we've put the rest of the team here over in Menlo Park. So they're neighbors. So I'd give you home court advantage when it comes to working with Sue and the team. And then you also come with an unbelievable reputation. We've worked with Stanford for a long time. We've worked in this community for a long time. You guys are an incredible story of everything that you've done here and in this ecosystem, and the whole world knows about it, even we. And we've camped out here, and we've part of one of the reasons was to be more a bigger part of this community, and to have dialogues like this and to rub up against each other so that we can find opportunities.
And yet,
that,
when I think about the typical venture capital portfolio out here, it doesn't seem to me there's a lot of technologies that are relevant to your strategic, or is that a misapprehension?
Yeah, and I mean, healthcare IT is probably one of the hotter spaces right now, even on the venture side, because this is, listen, healthcare needs connection, it needs quality, it needs decision support, and we're seeing a lot of activity on the IT side. And then molecular medicine, precision diagnostics, again, another hotbed for those types of technologies.
So when was the fund established, and is it too early to determine whether
you saw how he skated by that part.
I didn't touch you missed there. That. You missed that part of the three part.
I'll leave that to Sue. We'll publish that in a couple of years when she gets it all straightened out. But it does. Everyone says this, but this you can't score this thing out for 6 or 7 years. I tell you what we do, and Sue pushes this hard. We do create business relationships where we start consuming the technology these investment companies, and we actually sell into them and help them and enable them with some of our technology. So what I've been pleasantly surprised with is sort of the short-term transactional flow between the big companies and the smaller company in the fund. But long-term, we'll see.
Great. Well, maybe longer than 6 or 7 years based on the other returns here.
It's optimistic.
That may be optimistic. Well, again, for the last time, I'm going to thank you and tell everyone that there's a reception outside. And, John, it's been great having you here.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you.